In association with iFanboy, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we continue our conversation with Tony Harris. Here in part two, Tony explains his pursuit to create a freelance guild for comic book writers and artists to get better wages, health benefits, and retirement security. The guild is called SAGE, and it's an initiative that he began with Steve Niles. Tony explains the reasons why he thinks a guild is necessary and explains the very important differences that this is a guild and not a union. Then we talk about Tony's love of pulp hero fiction from the 1930s and 40s. It inspired the two JSA Liberty Files projects he did with writer Dan Jolly and informs his next project with writer B. Clay Moore, which was slated for Wildstorm, The Whistling Skull. According to recent tweets by B. Clay Moore, the project will move forward despite the recent news that the Wildstorm imprint was wrapping up. Our talk with Tony took place before the Wildstorm announcement happened. Today's episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Fanboy Legion. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to live in another world, another universe, another time? If you're a card-carrying member of the Geek Class, you've probably spent countless hours inside fantastic worlds of pure imagination. Books, comics, movies, TV, whether it's a magical realm of wizards and witches, fighting with a rebellion against an evil empire, or soaring through the skies in brightly colored spandex and cape, we all wondered what it would be like to be part of these amazing stories. Now, you can be a part of that magic and bring it with you wherever you go. FanboyLegion.com is home to the original Geek Badge, embroidered patches that represent your ability to meet goals, achieve skills, and complete amazing adventures from all the magical realms we spent all our lives dreaming about. Have you made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs? Have you scaled Mount Doom? Did you graduate from the School for Gifted Youngsters? If so, then you should own the limited edition merit badge that will show the world your achievements. Visit FanboyLegion.com today and join the coolest troop in the multiverse. Our conversation begins with Tony's explanation of why he wanted to create the guild called SAGE. You know, I want to talk about the guild, and I know you and Steve Niles have been trying to come up with a solution that has been a long problem in comics with freelancers and publishers. Healthcare is obviously on everyone's minds. It was one of the big planks of Obama's administration, and what's the status on what you've been trying to do?
Well, initially it started with me just doing violent volcanic rants on Twitter, just out of personal frustration. And I mean, I literally, in the past, I mean, this is not the first time I've done it either. I mean, I've cleared bars. You know, I've been in bars at conventions and brought it up, and I blink and I'm alone, me and the bartender. But it's something that Steve and I, we became friends a couple years ago, and we pretty quickly realized that that was a huge concern of ours and a passion, and we realized that it's been addressed and it's come up a bunch of times in the past. We're not the first guys to bring it up. We're not the first guys to talk about it. And I've kind of taken point on it, and because I got a big mouth and I'm not afraid of shit, basically. But we originally, once we gave it a name, you know, the Guild, SAGE, Sequential Arts and Entertainment Guild, because for the record, it's not a union, because freelance contractors cannot legally form a union because we would be violating antitrust laws.
Okay.
You cannot form a union unless you are an employee of the corporation, and all comic book artists and writers and letterers and colorists are all freelance contractors. So we cannot do that. So for the record, everyone listening, tell your friends, it's not a union. Never will be, can't be, unless someone wants to go to prison. But guilds are legal, and they're not necessarily a brother or sister to a union, but they do serve a lot of the same purpose, which is the interest and the betterment of freelance contractors in the form of, you know, health insurance and being treated better by publishers, which I'm going to go on the record and say freelancers are in large part treated like horseshit
Sure.
By publishers. Even guys like me who, you know, I've got a long career and I've worked for everybody out there. But it doesn't mean that I'm not having the same problems now that I had 21 years ago when I started as a newbie. And to me, it's a fucking sin. It's wrong that we are expected to carry ourselves and act like professionals and turn stuff in on time and meet deadlines and act right and do this and do that. But we are not given the opportunity to be a part of any sort of health plan with group insurance or if editorial or anybody in the accounting department makes a faux pas or someone doesn't process a voucher properly and your paycheck is not cut when it's supposed to be. Oh, well, fuck you. You don't get a phone call. You don't get an apology. You're not even told that there was a mistake made until a week or two later when you realize, well, shit, where's my paycheck? It hadn't come yet. Right. And then you have to go through the channels and whatever. But my point is, they expect freelancers to act like professionals, but they won't. And that's a broad statement, and it's not true as far as every editor and everybody in editorial admin goes at any publisher. But it's a double-sided sword. I mean, you know, one group can't say to another group, well, you need to do this. If they're not doing it, you can't, don't preach to me about what I'm doing wrong when you're not doing it right. And that's where a lot of this was born, in just, you know, loose talk and conversation. And then we started, reaching out to people on Twitter and on message boards and, just every available outlet and saying, hey, who feels the same way we do? And the outpouring was unbelievable. We got lawyers, and I mean antitrust lawyers, hooking up with us to say, hey, we'll work with you guys and do it all pro bono. We got designers and artists saying, we'll build the website for free, design the logo for free. And then all of a sudden everything just stalled. And I don't know what happened. It wasn't a lack of fervor on my part or Steve's. It was just the same problem that our industry has had for 50 years. And that is, you know, people get fired up. And they want to do this and they want to do that. And so, oh, yeah, I'm with you. Ha, ha, ha. And then no one does shit. And I can't force anybody to be proactive again, as I said, and do this and do that. And I tried to enlist people who offered their services and say, let's spread this thing out and let's allocate things, you know, smartly and say, instead of one or two guys trying to spearhead everything, let's spread the responsibility across the group and do this and this and this. And, you know, everyone gets busy with their jobs and their deadlines and everything else, and then things just get forgotten. It hasn't gone away. It's still there. Everyone who committed their services to the guild are still intact. It's just moving slowly. And quite frankly, that's kind of the way, in some small way, that we want it to go, because there have been, as I said, a lot of movements in the past for the same kinds of things, and they always just burned out and went away for whatever reason, whether it be, oh, we tried to do things too quickly or too rashly, we didn't make the right decisions. But we want to do things right and do them smartly so that the publishers and editorial admin all are willing to come to the table to talk, not to fight. We're not looking to strike. Obviously, we can't because it's not a union. It's a guild.
Right.
But we are looking to have a face to our group, which, you know, privately we do have several really hugely, massively popular freelancers that are willing to come out publicly for the guild. And that's what you need. You need a face. You need someone who you can't question, is irreproachable as far as their reputation and their creative skill goes, to be the face of your group, willing to sit at a table and talk to your, quote, betters, your publishers, your editors, whatever, and talk about things, negotiate things.
Right.
And that's all we want, really, is just to say, hey, you know, shit ain't working. It's not totally fucked up, but, man, there's some shit that needs to be fixed. Can we at least sit at the same table and discuss this stuff like grown-ups? And furthermore, like the grown-ups you want us to be. And one of my favorite things to say is, and recently has been, and it's not me, it's Howard Chaykin. I read an interview with him recently. It had to be within the last year, and I don't know where it was. And I'm paraphrasing here, I'm not quoting. But Howard said, and he's a dear friend, that one of the major problems with our industry is we have a proliferation of hobbyists who have made their profession, made their hobby their profession.
Yes.
And so they're not looking at it properly. They don't have the work ethic that they probably should have. And I'm not beyond reproach. I mean, you know, I've certainly made my mistakes over the years, but one thing I do have is I have a goddamn work ethic. And I think that's sorely lacking in the business. And maybe it's because I didn't read comics as a kid. I didn't collect them. I don't collect them fervently. But I think that we have too many guys who were just huge fans and got lucky and got into the business, and the mentality is just wrong. They're not necessarily treating it like a career or a serious job. That's just my opinion.
Understood. And yeah, you're saying that they don't look at it dispassionately and objectively, and take their love of the business out, and as you say, you know, kind of look at it as a business, as an occupation, and how the, you know, workers and are treated by the owners, and then what's the, you know,
the DC and Marvel, they are your clients.
There you go.
And it is your job to please your client. And if you do not please your client, they will hire another vendor.
Sure. Right.
I mean, it's that simple.
Certainly.
And I know a lot of guys don't want to think of it like that, but goddamn it, think of it like that, because that's what it is.
Sure.
You are replaceable. Any of us are. For every one of us that are working in the business, there's another 200 guys who are willing to cut their left fucking ear off to take your place in a heartbeat.
Or there's a generation behind you that, you know, were household names, you know, 15 years ago that, you know, for whatever reasons, the mainstream isn't, you know, going back to them, whether it's a style change, or I've heard of some writers and artists who kind of price themselves out of, you know, getting current jobs, and therefore, again, I mean, the same thing happens in my business, radio. Every graduation year, there's a new crop of kids that are very happy to be doing the same job at half the rate.
Yeah, and as you know, as a veteran, I guess is what I'm called now. If I want to command the rates that I ask for, I have to make sure I'm on top of my game, and I'm every bit as timely and relevant as anybody else working right now who's 20 years old. And that means I've got to stay on top of music. I got to stay on top of fashion.
Yep.
I got to stay on top of cars and architecture and popular culture, and not be dated with the shit that I'm doing, you know. And that's another default I think that a lot of guys just have faded away because they don't keep that stuff in the forefront. And I think a lot of that comes from, you know, I got a 15-year-old kid. And I look to him.
Sure.
You know, and I'm staying current because of my son.
No, I understand. I have two nephews that I, you know, that are 18 and 15, and I do the same thing. It's like they're our kind of, you know, in-house focus group of, yeah, what's going on? What do you guys like? Why do you like this as opposed to that? And no, I constantly do that. And that's one of the reasons why I think I'm convinced that new media is such a good, you know, place to be in terms of what I try to do. Because I know I see the consumption of computer content versus television and radio. And I know which box is winning. And right now it's the computer. So, you know, I mean, that's fine. I mean, that, you know. So for the purposes of the Guild, though, have there been any preliminary discussions with people on the publishing side, or is it still too early and you guys are still kind of, you know, putting together your platform, for a lack of a better word?
No, it's too early. We're still solidifying the platform because I don't want to go to anybody, and none of us do, until we have an absolutely platform. And that means talking lawyers and setting up a nonprofit LLC. And making sure that all of our ducks are in a row.
Sure.
Because if you go to the table before you have all that stuff set up, then they're not going to take you seriously, you know?
Understood. Well, and like you say, it's only been a couple months. You know, I mean, that Twitter rant, was it before or after? It was after C2E2.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is, you know, literally like, you know, about 3 or 4 months ago. So.
Yeah, and I said early on in all that torrent that we were going to take baby steps.
Sure.
And if that means it takes 6 months, a year, 2 years, whatever, I don't care. That's what it's going to take, you know? I mean, you know, real change does not ever happen quickly. I mean, it's always like, you know, snail speed.
Absolutely, man. I know from coming from sports, you know, reading that, and I can't remember the name of the book, but there was that excellent history of how long it took for baseball to come up with the Players Association. And, you know, Marvin Miller and Curt Flood and those guys, you know, how they it took a long time, and it took a lot of resistance and tug of war. But it is, you know, with the idea of, as you say, coming up with the right platform and also doing it level-headed and not in a demanding sort of way, and maybe
not in an ugly way.
Right.
You have to be a professional and handle yourself like a professional, or your publishers are not ever going to take you seriously.
Sure.
You know, and I invite anybody listening to this podcast, I'm going to give you my personal email address right now, shipwreck@cox.net. If you want to be a part of this, and you want to make a real change for the better, not to hurt us or the publishers, but just to improve the industry and the conditions that we all work under, get in touch with me at shipwreck@cox.net.
And that's real, because that's how I contact Tony. So I can verify that to be Tony's real email. So excellent, man. Well, that's very cool. And good luck. I mean, as far as the Guild goes, I mean, I know you guys feel strongly about it. I understand the questions that some people have about what you guys are trying to do, and I think dialogue is the only way to resolve, you know, both sides of this thing, and you reach a point where everyone feels like they're being treated fairly, and there's nothing wrong with that, and nothing wrong with pursuing that. So good luck with it.
Yeah, and you know what? I'm one of the few guys who are willing to actually say anything. Everyone's afraid. You know, and I could be fucking blackballed tomorrow. Who knows? You know, I don't know. But I'm just sick. I'm sick of, you know, a lot of things. But the deal is that until the freelance community bands together as a group, and I'm not, again, for the record, I'm not talking about any kind of union because it's illegal. We can't do that. But until we band together as a group, then guess what? It's every man for himself.
That's right.
And I've come across a lot of that with people that I've spoken to, where they're like, I got a family, I got kids. Guess what? So do I.
Sure.
Guess what? I got 21 years in the business, and I got my future livelihood on the line. But I don't want certain things, not all things, but certain things to continue on the way that they are, and they can't be improved. And it's just through dialogue that that's going to happen. But there's just this embedded fear among freelancers that, I don't want to rock the boat. I can't do that. I might get fired. I might get blackballed, whatever. And until that mentality changes, nothing is ever going to happen. Not ever.
I understand. Well, I also think that we're in an interesting time creatively, in all forms of media right now, where the ability to do your own thing is becoming easier and easier. And I see you know, examples of success. I mean, I just talked to Mark Miller, 2 weeks ago, and look at how he's able to, take his success and, package it and get with the right people to start trying to do some of these other things, on his own.
Speaking of Mark, I'm back to work on War Heroes. We're going to finish that up.
Oh, good. Is that true?
To everyone, I'm finishing War Heroes. Yes,
good.
Absolutely true. Yeah, I've already started pages on issue 4. So
excellent, man. Okay, because Mark and I only had about 20 minutes, so I pretty much spoke about Clint, and I'm glad you bring it up. So I'll bring up War Heroes, and we're supposed to talk again in the next few days. So I'll get.
Well, here's our plan. I talked to Mark. I talked to our agent and my attorney. And okay, a lot of people know we already sold the film to Sony. So it's supposed to be a movie, but things got stalled out because Mark got sick pretty badly for a while, and then I got busy with some other stuff because he got sick. And then when he got better, we did the War Heroes tour.
Okay, so you're talking about when he had Crohn's, when he had the really bad bout of Crohn's and everything?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it was really terrible.
Oh, I know.
A lot of people are not aware of that, and they just think that Mark and I flaked out, and we said, oh, fuck it, we got our movie deal, that's it, fuck it. No, that's not the case. Mark got sick. He got really sick. And then deadlines piled up on him. They piled up on me. I had to make a living. He had to make a living,
sure.
So we went on to do other things, and we put the book on hiatus for a little bit. So anyway, long story short, it snowballed, and then we did the War Heroes tour, and then all this movie stuff started happening for Mark, and he started having to travel a lot to do promotional stuff, which is absolutely necessary for that. I mean, it's not a choice. You have
to, oh, absolutely.
You have to do it, and. All that happened, and so anyway, Mark and I got back together recently and talked about it and spoke to our agent, and the idea we came up with was, I'm back on the book now, I'm doing pages again, Mark's writing the final script, and instead of just putting the issues out willy-nilly as we finish them, we're going to wait until I'm drawing the last half of issue 6.
Okay.
And we're going to re-release 1, 2, and 3 in a mini trade, and then 4, 5, and 6 monthly right after that.
Okay.
And then put the trade paper back out, and then the hardcover, and then go to Europe.
And when you say go to Europe, you mean publish it in Europe, or?
Yeah, we already have deals in place to release the entire thing as a graphic novel in Europe. So
okay, all right.
As soon as we finish here with the trade and the hardcover, then we'll go straight to Europe.
Okay, and domestically, it's through Dynamite, correct, or was it through Image? I can't remember.
It's Image.
It is Image. Okay. Well, would you guys, was the idea even floated about putting it in Clint or no?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. No,
okay.
No, we started with Image, and we're going to finish through them. So
okay, that's cool. Oh, that's great, man. Well, I'm glad to hear that. That's fantastic. And then also, I want to talk because, you know, I know Clay Moore has been excited about this project that you guys have started cooking up, and you guys had your panel at C2E2 for it. And and as I was talking to Tony, I got the name wrong twice, so I'm going to I'm right there now on the cover that you can see, or the promo art. I don't know. Is that a cover at the Wildstorm Bleed blog, or is that a promotional piece?
Which piece?
For the Further Adventures of the Whistling Skull, sir. I see it here on this was a blog post for the Wildstorm blog called The Bleed. It was over C2E2. It was Saturday, April 17th.
Oh, when they announced the book. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a promotional piece.
Okay.
It's just something I did to show Wildstorm when we were pitching the book to them.
Gotcha. And so let's talk about the Whistling Skull. And obviously you've already spoke about your love for 40s retro things, and I'm a big 40s pulp fan as well, and clearly this has its roots in the pulp tradition.
Oh, yeah, baby.
Nothing wrong with that, man. I'm talking to Brubaker in a few days about his little pulp things, like Incognito. So,
fewer things on the planet get me hard more than the 40s, baby.
Do you have a lot of pulp? Do you have a lot of pulp magazines and stuff?
I do.
Cool.
And all the old Shadow magazines and even the pocketbooks with that came out in the like 60s and 70s that were reprints and stuff.
The Steranko covers.
Yeah.
Exactly. I love that stuff. Love that stuff. And Doc Savage, the James Bama covers and stuff like that.
Oh, Bama is the shit. Dude.
No lie, man. I'm a big fan.
No, but, you know, ever since I got into comics, I've always gravitated more towards the Golden Age stuff. And again, I can't even tell you why. Just because.
Well, dude, if I may, because I wanted to acknowledge it because I loved it so much. You and Dan Jolly doing the Liberty File for JSA.
Oh, huge love of mine.
Truly, I mean, truly one of my favorites. No lie.
That was my baby. That was my quote mainstream tour de force. That was my contribution to superhero comics. Because I don't really like them. but I sure do like the Golden Age, and I love the way the costumes looked.
Yep.
Then and just the way guys, again, like I said earlier, the way guys and gals talked and dressed, and Dan and I got to do everything that we wanted to do in that book. You know, right down to the dialogue. I mean, you know, Dan did all kind of research and made sure that it was right, and
who was your editor on that?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because we did a sequel to the Liberty File, The Unholy Three.
Yes.
And, again, for the record, we have enough material to do three more sequels, each sequel being two 64-page books that bring you all the way up into the 60s. But we just haven't pursued it.
Why not?
We kind of went our separate ways. I mean,
okay.
You know, Dan went off and did his thing. I went off and did my thing. We got busy with this and that. But my colorist, J.D. Mettler, actually co-wrote a bunch of the sequel material. And I'm not going to say never. Yeah, it might happen. Who knows?
I hope so.
Because that definitely was a major highlight for mainstream work for me. That was so much fun.
Well, before we get into the Skull, I want to talk about the JSA in particular, because that's the one thing that's been driving me crazy. I really think that what's been missing in this modern age of great writing to match great art is to go back to the 40s and tell more Justice Society stories back in the 40s when these guys were in their prime. I love
them. They're my favorite.
Yeah.
They're my absolute favorite superheroes. Just the characters themselves, their names, and I mean, we were able to distill that down in Liberty File to the Bat.
Yes.
the clock. And what do we do for Dr. Midnight?
I can't remember either.
Oh, Christ. oh shit, what do we do for him? Oh, we did the clock for Allerman, the bat for bat.
Sure.
Oh shit, I can't remember. What we
yeah,
did
I can't. I can't either, man. But that's the thing. It's like you guys
oh,
really.
Oh, the owl.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. Of course.
Yeah, the owl. So we just distilled it down to like, and I remember our initial conversation about that book when Dan and I were talking about it was like, okay, what if these guys were not superheroes? What if they were spies?
Yeah, OSS agents. That's the vibe you got. Absolutely.
Yeah. What if they were spies? What would their code names be? And so that's where all that was born. And like, okay, now that we have their code names, how can we make their outfits look like covert shit they would put on? And that's why we did, Hourman. We put that big-ass turban on his head. and just draped him in, you know, look. Basically, we put him in the Lawrence of Arabia. But no, that was a blast. That was such a blast.
See, and I remember them more in plain clothes. I don't remember that Lawrence. I'm gonna have to go back and find my Liberty file.
Well, yeah, there was a whole scene where he had this huge turban that had like these little coins attached to like a ring around the front of his turban.
Okay.
And he had this scarf around his neck, and like he goes into a bar called Hassan's, and all these Nazi fuckers are in there with like suits and trench coats and stuff on, and he ends up picking up a piano and, like, throwing a piano on top of these Nazi guys. And then, for some reason, they end up on horses and camels in the desert and then flying a Sopwith camel biplane.
Jesus.
It was just insane. We put all the stuff we ever wanted to do from the 40s and then, like, we're just channeling Lawrence of Arabia.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
But no, we have tons of sequel stuff. And the prequel. We have a prequel for Liberty File, which is all based on Starman, Ted, and Wes, Sandman.
Oh, fantastic.
And the whole story, it's a one-shot, 64-page. And they're best buddies, they're partners, and Ted, and it's in Elseworlds, so we were able to weave in some extra shit. So in the Elseworlds, we have Ted has two sons, Jack and David, back stateside, and he's married, but he's having an affair with Black Canary.
Yes.
Who we featured in Liberty File.
Yeah, I do remember that, yes. Okay, I remember seeing her in Liberty File, certainly.
Yeah, she opened a bar in Egypt as a singer, the Canary. And the reason for that, and here's the backstory on that, is because she was having a torrid affair with Ted while his wife and two sons were back stateside.
Sure.
Because they were agents and they got involved. And Wes was Sandman. Was running interference for Ted when he was meeting Canary in hotels for little trips. One of them in the story got of where they were and burst into the room with machine guns and ended up shooting Ted in the leg, which crippled him and caused him to have to retire from field service as an agent. And in our sequel, The Unholy Three, you remember he went up against Superman at the end.
Right.
And it was because he was relegated to being a scientist because of his wound. And Canary felt so guilty about what happened to him because she knew how passionate he was about being a field agent that she left the service and bought a bar in Egypt and started singing as a canary. And so we tell that entire story in the prequel and the death of Wildcat.
Interesting. Very cool.
It's all written down, baby.
Very cool, man. No, I love it. I love it. No, I and dude, especially being a boxing fan and stuff, my God, Ted Grant, huge fan, huge fan. I was thrilled when Clay started writing those couple wild Wildcats that he got to do in JSA Classified and stuff.
Yeah,
with, I want to say Ramon Perez, if I remember correctly. But, all right, well, moving on to the Whispering Skull. The Whistling Skull. See, I did it again, motherfucker.
You son of a bitch.
Motherfucker. I know, I'm an asshole. The Whistling Skull. The Further Adventures of the Whistling Skull.
It's the Stuttering Fuck.
I can't help it. Yeah, you are free to call
me
that.
My new book is called The Stuttering Fuck.
Who whistles? Nice. But this is so it's a London story. Are these all is it an all British cast, or are these Americans in London? What's going on?
No, it's an all British cast. The whole book takes place in London during World War II. And it's a very pulp noir thing, and it's hard to, I have to get like a tagline from Clay. I have to get him to write me like a fucking 2-sentence thing that says what it's about. But it takes place during the war in London, and our main character, his name is Nigel, in real life, but his alter ego is the Whistling Skull, who is a crime fighter and a doer of good. And his sidekick is called Brickfist. No, I'm sorry, Knuckles. Brickfist was the original name, but...
Oh, it's changed. Okay, because in the blog it still says Brickfist, too. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually Knuckles now, which is actually more 1940s and even better. His name is Knuckles, and if I'm not mistaken, I think we're the first comic to... Knuckles is mentally handicapped. He's about 30 years old, but he's got the mind of a 9-year-old, and he is the Skull's sidekick, and he's almost 8 feet tall. And we're not treating it in a comedic way. We're doing it totally straight. But I think if I'm not mistaken, I think we're the first book in comics to have a main character be mentally handicapped.
Interesting.
And Clay's sister actually works with a halfway house.
Oh, I didn't know that.
With mentally handicapped people, yeah. And so Clay actually, as research, went with his sister to the house. I think you have to ask Clay. Maybe follow up with him.
Absolutely.
This is correct. But he went over there for quite a while, and he's got kids too. So I said, you know, the key to writing and drawing a mentally handicapped adult who's got the mind of a 9-year-old is not treating them like they're fucking idiots. Because guess what? They're not.
Of course not.
Okay, because guess what? I got 3 kids. I got a 15-year-old, 11-year-old, and a 3-year-old. And at no point in time was my 15-year-old or my 11-year-old, when they were 9, they were nowhere near idiots.
I understand.
And so he's got kids, too. So what we're doing is we're using our kids and our memories of our kids when they were 9 as a touchstone for how Nigel should be portrayed in the book.
Okay.
And then Clay went and did this research with his sister and spent time with people observing to make sure he gets it right. Because, again, this is not comedy. We're not making fun of anybody. And honestly, I really do think that this is one of the main reasons why DC and Wildstorm bought the book as quickly as they did. Because they recognized what we were trying to do with that character. Because Nigel really is the heart of the book. Skull's the main character, but Nigel, he's the heart. He's that innocent mind that hasn't been spoiled by becoming an adult, you know?
Sure, and I think for people who don't, you know, for American audiences, you know, 1940s Britain really was, you know, obviously, literally the front line. I mean, the bombing was going on. Right.
Oh, shit. Yeah.
On their
yeah.
doorsteps. I mean, that was when the subway bombings were happening in London. the Londoners really had the right attitude. And you saw these people in their 70s and 80s who literally were like, I've been bombed before and by bigger villains than you. Bring it on. And they had exactly. that right, passionate kind of, you know, because they had. They had been through it before. And I really had a lot more respect and admiration for them going through this horror.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we embraced was, you know, this war-torn, you know, tapestry behind guys who, you know, it's hard to explain. The skull is like a mantle that's willed to another generation.
Oh, so there's a legacy? It's kind of a legacy mantle?
Yeah, it is. And there was an original skull many, many, many years ago, back in like the 1800s, and we haven't established exactly when the first one happened. But when before he died, there's a law firm called Phineas Teagle and Sons that handles the entire estate of the skull. And when we start our series, the skull you're following is number 7. So there's 6 before him.
Right.
And Phineas Teagle and Sons has been around since the very beginning, generation after generation after generation. And they've always handled that estate and the money and the mantle and passed it down to one guy after another. But each skull has to pick his...
Successor?
Yeah. And handpicked his successor and put it in his will. So if he dies or disappears in the course of being the skull, this crime fighter, this doer of good, this writer of wrongs, then a letter is sent from Phineas Teagle and Sons to his successor, beckoning him to come to London and meet with the attorneys, and they make him the offer, and he has to say yes or no. The skull right before number 7, who we start our story with, he vanishes at the beginning of the story, but his son, who is Nigel Knuckles,
right,
is being taken care of by Phineas Teagle and Sons and lives in a mansion in London. And our skull, number 7, is a street urchin who befriends him on the sly and is a pretty crafty kid. And they become really good friends over the course of like 20 years while Knuckles' dad is like traveling the globe as a skull.
I see.
So when he vanishes, he names William, the skull number 7, as his successor. But there's a contingency on the whole thing. He has to take Nigel / Knuckles on as his ward.
Okay.
And so he does.
Interesting.
Because they're best friends anyway. They have been since they were small. So he becomes number 7. Our story picks up right there when he becomes number 7. Actually, we show you number 6 disappearing, Knuckles' father, at the beginning of the story, and then we just throw you right into the middle of the whole thing.
Is this a miniseries? Is it an ongoing? What's the plan for it?
We're using Hellboy as a model.
Okay.
Originally, we were going to do it as a monthly, 40 issues, but we decided to use Hellboy the model and do like a series of miniseries.
Sure.
Because I'm burned out on monthly.
Understood.
So the first arc is 6 issues.
And when does it begin?
I'm starting it next week.
It comes out next week, or it...
No, I'm starting it next week.
Oh, I see. You're starting to draw it. I was going to say, holy cow.
Yeah, and I'm actually traditionally painting all the covers for this.
Fantastic.
Because the logo is, like, really huge, like the old pulp magazine.
I know. I see that on the promo art. Absolutely.
Yeah,
very cool.
Yeah, so the actual art for the cover is going to be, like, a square instead of a tall rectangle piece. And so they want me to go ahead and paint all the covers so they can use them in promotion and whatnot. And that'll take me about a month to do all six. And then I start the pages right after that. And once I start the pages, it'll take me about 2 months per issue.
Okay.
And so I'm actually inking everything myself and doing like a gray wash type stuff over the art.
Interesting. Very cool. All right. So yeah, this will be a new departure then, as you say, from the previous styles.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is going back to what I've. You know, I just adore more than anything. So we're going to switch up the look, switch up the style, and I will be working with my colorist from Machina, J.D. Mettler. So.
Very cool. Are there old pulp artists that, you know, were inspirational in terms of the design for this?
Not really, because, I mean, like I said, I didn't read comics when I was young.
Right.
All my influences were, like, turn-of-the-century American illustrators. My favorite being like Howard Pyle.
Okay.
And like, you know, J.C. Leindecker, Norman Rockwell is a huge inspiration to me.
That does surprise me. And again, going back to your photo, you know, reference stuff and everything,
see
that.
I just got his book recently, about all his photo work. It's an amazing book.
I heard one of his nephews was a big comic strip artist, and I can't remember the name now. But I was reading it.
I have not heard that.
In one of the Tomorrow's publications, I was reading about a Rockefeller, and I want to say he was either a Kniff assistant or, you know, one of the big comic strips. He was an assistant and did a lot of daily work and stuff. I thought that was pretty interesting.
Oh. No, I hadn't heard that. You know, those guys and like who else? Dean Cornwell, Alphonse Mucha, who was not an American illustrator, but amazing nonetheless. Jesus Christ, they're endless. Flagg. Any American illustrator from the turn of the century has absolutely been, you know, my main inspiration.
Okay. You know, you got to come to town. Chicago has a very good pulp show. Right, and in fact, it was the weekend after C2E2. And it's
no way.
Yeah, it's a great show. And really, like, you know, Jeff Darrow shows up for it, and like as a buyer. And you know, it's funny. Steranko and Jerry Conway come to town just to be, you know, guys diving in the you know, sales bins just like everybody else. They're not there to be guests. They're there looking for cool stuff too. And
wow.
And it's a good show. It really is kind of a flea markety old fashioned show, but the dealers there in particular are really, you know, hardcore pulp guys, and they have great stuff. And then they always get this collection of amazing painted covers from the 20s and 30s and 40s and on of all the men's adventure magazines and all the pulps and stuff. And it's really great. I mean, they had an original Captain Morgan painting, which I thought was fantastic. But
nice.
But yeah, tons of men's adventure magazines and stuff. In fact, I should show you. I took photographs of a bunch of the paintings and stuff. They're really great.
Well, that's what I'm modeling all the covers on the skull after, is that same sort of square illustration format where the logos were so big that the actual live art area is more of a square.
Sure.
So, if you look at the artist compositions on those pieces, they're very cramped and tight. Like, the guy will be holding a pistol, but it looks like he's hunched over and the pistol's up next to his face.
Exactly, sure.
And some chick is, like, stuffed into a fucking bus station locker or some shit, you know?
Nice. That's awesome, man. How about, did you ever listen to the old radio shows of, you know, The Shadow and stuff?
Oh, yeah, I've got all the old Shadow shows on CD, and they're a mainstay in the studio, yeah.
I'm always impressed with, like, a lot of those guys wrote comics as well. And, you know, like Alfred Bester, the guy who wrote The Stars Are Destination and who came up with In Brightest Day and Blackest Night, the whole recital and everything. That he wrote Shadow scripts and he wrote Green Lantern stuff.
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't know, too, that Orson Welles did the voice of the Shadow.
You bet.
In that serial. So, I mean, and you can totally hear it, too, if you know his work. So
definitely. But, you know, I like Brett Morrison, too. I liked all the Shadows. I want to say either Jay Johnstone or Ray Johnstone. I forget his name, but he was the guy in between, one of the guys in between Welles and Brett Morrison. But, I love all that pulpy stuff, man, and I love all the old detective shows like that, and I Love a Mystery, another great show, very pulpy.
Well, I mean, what I love so much about all the old, like, serials that ran in theaters, in movie theaters back in the 40s, was, and this is kind of what I use when I draw, quote, superheroes or guys in costumes, is the whole Buster Crabbe, like, barrel-chested, you know, oh, it's clear that I'm wearing a costume, but I still look cool as shit.
Oh, absolutely. Dude, I met that guy in his 70s, and he still was a big, giant, imposing dude.
You met Buster Crabbe?
I sure did, man. I got a picture of me at 12 years old next to Buster Crabbe.
Oh, shit, that would have been badass.
It's a fond memory, and he was incredible. And, you know, this guy was an Olympic swimmer and continued to swim throughout his life. And the guy, even in his 70s, had this big... I wouldn't mess with Buster Crabbe at 70 years old. He was incredible. Johnny Weissmuller kind of got fat in his old age. Buster Crabbe could still fall off and kill you.
He's another great example of that physique that I sort of call on.
Sure.
When I'm doing, quote, superhero stuff. Is I love that sort of non... it's not ripped, you know, bodybuilder shit, which I can't stand that with superhero costumes. It just looks fake and disingenuous. But I love the whole Crabbe, Weissmuller sort of barrel-chested, big-ass motherfucker who will whoop your ass.
Definitely.
But they wear the costume well, but it's not like it's painted on. You know what I mean?
No, I agree. You know that Sandy Cholera who did that Batman Dead End fan film, I mean, he kind of showed us that you don't need armor to make Batman look like a badass. If you get a guy with the right build, he could pull off the spandex and still look pretty tough and very, you know, threatening and real. And, I mean, it's tough to find an actor that can, I think, do that combination of giving you the acting chops plus the physicality necessary to do a role. But, I mean, you know.
Shit, let me tell you something. My colorist, J.D. Mettler, he is 6'6". And that motherfucker weighs almost 300 pounds. And he used to wrestle motherfuckers on his concrete driveway with nothing but a pair of shorts on. And I said, why do you do that shit? So I can feel alive. You don't need some cut, muscle-bound bodybuilder to be a powerful son of a bitch. I wouldn't cross J.D. Mettler with two sticks.
There you go, man. No, and that's what I liked about your design for Liberty Files, because they did. They evoked that kind of serial attempt at doing a costume. And with the exception of Kirk Allen and I forget the actor's name that did Batman, but the Superman and Batman series were one thing. But even Captain America, it was more of a uniform. And in that same design that you had for, like I say, the Liberty Files, and also in this promo art that you have for the skull as well.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'm totally channeling that stuff. And the fact that you can see it tells me that there'll be a lot of folks that get what I'm trying to do.
I think so.
Yeah, there's not going to be any, you know, vacuum-formed costume-type shit in the Whistling Skull. It's going to be... interesting. I mean, I can't really say anything about it at this point, specifically about story. But if you like my work, I can't imagine that you would not be doing backflips over Skull. It's if you dig my stuff and you have on any level in the last 21 years, Skull is going to be everything that you would hope my next project would be. I mean,
Excellent. And I know, again, Clay's a good writer to hook up with for that stuff because, again, he's got that same sensibility, and we've seen it in things like Hawaiian Dick, his little one-shot issue that he did for Doc Savage, and also...
And Battle Him.
Battle Him's one of my favorites, absolutely. Him and Jeremy Hahn are very...
I mean, Clay's got an absolute reverence for that period and the material, so...
You're right.
He was definitely the right choice.
That's excellent, man. No, I'm happy for both of you, and I'm excited for this project. And, yeah, Battle Him absolutely was one of the first things that got me excited about Clay's work. So, very cool. Very cool, Tone. I like it.
Thank you, sir.
What else on the immediate future? I mean, obviously, I guess painting the skull covers are going to take up a lot of your time right now.
Yeah, that's going to take about a month, and then I'll jump into the pages at that point. And I've got another project that some people know about, some don't. I've been developing it for... Jesus, probably 10 years. It's called Round Eye.
Okay.
And if you have seen my art book that came out this year, it's a 315-page, 20-year retrospect. Came out through IDW and Desperado.
Yes. Talk about that for a second. Sure.
Yeah. It's a 20-year retrospect. It covers everything right back to my self-publishing days in 1989, right out of high school, all the way up to present day, and permission from everybody, from Lucasfilm to Marvel, DC, Universal Studios. So everything I've done, there's a sampling of that in the book for 20 years.
It's an oversized,
like, coffee table book.
Fantastic, and now you mentioned Universal. That was your work on The Mummy.
Yeah.
And then what did you do for Lucas?
A bunch of Star Wars covers over at Dark Horse.
Okay.
For the, what was it called? They reimagined.
Oh, I remember those. Yes, they were kind of what-ifs, where the story would have turned into different ways. I absolutely remember those stories. Those are great stories.
Yeah. Yeah, I did, I think it was like four covers, and I did a bunch of designs and sketches for covers that did not get used, and we actually got permission from Lucasfilm to actually print all that stuff, too, so no one's ever even seen that stuff.
Oh, fantastic. Very cool. Well, that's great, Ben. All right, so there's a great book from IDW and Desperado to look for. What's the title for the book?
It's called Tony Harris Art and Skullduggery.
Fantastic.
One L.
Very cool.
Which is the proper spell.
I didn't know that. Really? For skullduggery, it's only one L? I had no idea.
Yeah.
There you go. Excellent.
It means evil deeds for money.
Makes sense. Very cool.
Yeah, if you know me, it makes sense.
Well, Duke, congratulations. Honestly, I'm glad that Ex Machina wrapped up so nicely, and powerful art in that last issue. And for Trade Waiters, I know you won't be disappointed. Look forward to the Whistling Skull, and again, we get this retrospective from IDW and Desperado. That's very cool.
Thank you so much, John. And one last thing, I just recently left the internet.
Are you unplugged?
Yeah.
Really?
Sort of. And here's the weird thing. James Robinson and myself did it the same day.
Wow.
And it was not orchestrated, I promise you. But I was spending too much time on message boards and Facebook and MySpace and Twitter and not creating art and concentrating on the job. And so a couple days ago, I just unplugged everything and deleted everything. So,
wow.
So it's all gone, and the only thing I kept was my website, which is about to relaunch very soon. It's being rebuilt right now by the same guy that did the special feature stuff for Isotope that you mentioned.
For Ex Machina, yeah.
Yeah. He built our site, and that's going to launch very soon with a lot of the same features that's on that stuff. And that's JollyRogerStudios.com.
Okay.
And my other connection to the web is, of course, my email, which I gave out earlier.
Right.
And I have a blog, which I just updated. And that is artandskullduggery.blogspot.com.
Okay. One L for skullduggery.
Yeah.
That's cool. Well, that's
and that's it for me. Everything else I turned off. I don't go on message boards, no Twitter, no nothing. So.
All right. Well, I'll miss our back and forth on Twitter that we just had about Darwin Cook and Mark Wade and their comments.
Right?
So, and that was the thing. You know, I was just being snarky, and for listeners who might have missed it, because I still do use Twitter and Facebook because got to promote the podcast. Got to keep.
Exactly.
See, you already got the audience, Tony. I'm still growing my audience. I was saying, I'm like, all right, who are we supposed to be mad at? Are we supposed to be mad at Mark Wade? Are we supposed to be mad at Darwin Cook? Who the fuck cares? It wasn't to diminish their arguments because I wasn't at Baltimore, but I read Mark's transcript and I heard part of his speech and I understood where he was coming from. And the same goes with Darwin. The only thing I would disagree with on what Darwin Cook's comments were specifically about Batwoman, just because, you know, I had Ruck on so many times while Batwoman was being created, and he was very emphatic that it wasn't Kathy Kane from the 50s and 60s. This was a different character. So,
right.
You know, and that's why I just kind of shrugged when Darwin said it. And also that it's Darwin just being flippant at a convention, but, you know, in typical media fashion, everyone's got to beat a quote to death that I think it gets, you know, it gets out of proportion, and it suddenly becomes this ridiculous, you know, thing that I don't think Cook intended in the first place.
It's sensationalism is what it is, and quite frankly, that's a huge reason why I split off the net. I mean, it's piss and vitriol.
Yes,
I mean, it really is.
No, I understand, man. Well, that's.
And I just had my fill of it.
I understand. Well, I hope that, you know, you'll still come back and occasionally talk on the podcast here, because one of the things that I want to do is give people. And creators in particular, the forum to, you know, speak their mind, and if, you know, let them speak and let their words be heard in the context that it was intended, and not taken out of context the way that quotes and even video clips sometimes are. And that's why, as we hit 2 hours on our conversation, that's kind of what I hope for, is, you know, that kind of unfiltered, like, this is what I think. And it's, you know, again, not that you're trying to change the world, you're just, you know, speaking your view, and it's okay.
Yeah, I appreciate the opportunity, John. Thank you very much. And hopefully I didn't piss anybody else. And if I did, suck me.
Just a quick postscript to our conversation with Tony Harris. Again, the Wildstorm announcement came after our interview. Again, B. Clay Moore on Twitter said that the project is moving forward, but we're not sure if that means that DC will still do it or if they're going to pursue an Image deal for the book. So if there's any inaccuracies in what was said in our original conversation, Word Balloon apologizes and afford Tony Harris the opportunity to correct us in the future. And when we get that information, we will be very happy to provide that to the listening audience. This episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by Fanboy Legion. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to live in another world, another universe, or another time? If you're a card-carrying member of the Geek Class, you probably spent countless hours inside fantastic worlds of pure imagination. Books, comics, movies, TV, whether it's a magical realm of wizards and witches fighting with a rebellion against an evil empire, or soaring through the skies in brightly colored spandex and cape, we've all wondered what it would be like to be part of these amazing stories. Now, you can bring a part of that magic with you wherever you go. Fanboy Legion.com is home to the original Geek Badge, embroidered patches that represent your ability to meet goals, achieve skills, and complete amazing adventures from all the magical realms we've spent all our lives dreaming about. Have you made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs? Have you scaled Mount Doom? Did you graduate from the School for Gifted Youngsters? If so, then you should own the limited edition merit badge that shows the world your achievements. Visit FanboyLegion.com today and join the coolest troop in the multiverse. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening to this episode of Word Balloon. As always, you can find Word Balloon at our website, wordballoon.com. There's well over 300 episodes in our archive of comic book creators talking about our favorite pop culture subjects. questions or comments about the show, reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. We're days away from the New York Comic Con. I hope to see you there. I will be hanging around the iFanboy booth and milling around the aisles just like you and preparing new future shows for Word Balloon. Until next time, thanks again for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2010.